the seven deadly sins, also known as the capital vices or cardinal sins, is a grouping and classification of vices within Christian teachings. These are known as behaviors that are specifically responsible for the rise in other immoralities. The seven sins are pride, gluttony, lust, sloth, envy, wrath, and greed. The one that drives humans to do the most immoral. Sure, there are crimes of lust, crimes of passion, and crimes of rage, but crimes of greed are just as powerful and sometimes twice as impactful. Greed can bring about immense wealth and power for those who succumb to it, and under the wrong circumstances, it can be deadly. Just like in the story of Ed Baker. In a desolate rice field, 2 miles north of Katy, Texas, flames engulfed a luxurious Jaguar sedan on November 8, 1985. Among the wreckage, sheriff's deputies discovered charred human remains. The remains were so horrifically disfigured that discerning the gender proved impossible. The police could only look into the owner of the vehicle, and that is where they found their first clue. The vehicle belonged to Edward Gerald Baker, a 52-year-old millionaire from Houston. Subsequent forensic examinations overwhelmingly confirmed the grim truth. The incinerated body was indeed his. During the 1980s, Ed epitomized the essence of Texas. The man was formidable, audacious, and affluent. Starting from humble beginnings as a shoe salesman and insurance agent, he swiftly ascended to the echelons of wealth with a multi-million dollar oil investment empire. Yet, to this day, the precise circumstances of his death remain a mystery. Some speculate he ended his own life, while others vehemently assert foul play. And even more surprising, there are some who believe that he faked his death and is still alive today. But to have any chance of finding answers, we have to look at just how he got so successful in the first place. Ed appeared an unlikely candidate to be entangled in such a perplexing story. His enterprise, Vanguard Groups International, burgeoned as one of the nation's fastest-growing corporations. The company was established in 1978 with the aim of constructing affordable housing. Then, in 1980, the company pivoted to vending limited partnerships in commercial real estate. Witnessing its evolution was Ed's second wife, Mary Walker, who observed his tireless efforts to build the business from the ground up. She attests to his unwavering belief in his potential for substantial success and his vocal commitment to managing the enterprise with honesty and integrity. But what if she was wrong? Ed embarked on oil well promotion in 1980, impeccably timing his foray with Houston's economic boom. With the triumph of his initial oil ventures, he encountered little difficulty in persuading wealthy investors to participate in his well-crafted tax shelters. Mary recalls how Ed earned the trust of others, lauded as a remarkably astute strategist in the realm of tax shelter development. She emphasizes that while laws have since evolved during that era, his strategies were considered nothing short of brilliant. When Ed established Vanguard, Mary was one of only 3 employees, and their filing system consisted of nothing more than cardboard boxes. Within 4 years, Vanguard's sales soared to a staggering $19 million, ushering in a tidal wave of wealth that precipitated profound changes in Ed's life. In March of 1984, after a decade of marriage, he parted ways with Mary. Subsequently, he embarked on a spree of high-stakes gambling, underwent 2 facelifts, took up disco dancing lessons, and acquired a flamboyant new Jaguar. By September of 1984, Ed had remarried. He tied the knot with Karen Walbridge, only to initiate divorce proceedings a mere 5 months later. Within days of finalizing the dissolution, he got married to 49-year-old Sandra Hoff, whom he referred to as Sandy. Ed spent a long time enjoying his newfound wealth. But that time was coming to an end. Ed's personal attorney, Ward Beese, briefed him on the detrimental impact of the plummeting crude oil prices in 1985. According to Ward, the oil industry inflicted significant harm on numerous individuals in Houston, leading to a cessation of investments in the very ventures that made Baker a very rich man. This would be a nightmare for Ed because of what he was doing behind the scenes. Baker had been borrowing extensively from his investors to sustain his lavish lifestyle, perpetually banking on the assumption that he could reimburse them with funds from new investor groups. With no new investors coming on, Ed was faced with quite a dilemma. According to Ward, Baker faced the looming allegations from many of his investors, alongside formidable tax liabilities, all of which could land him in prison. For Ed, it may have seemed like the walls were closing in. Not only was he about to lose the money, but he was on the verge of losing his freedom as well. He had to do something, and it may have been the very thing that caused his death. By October of 1985, Ed was being hounded by his investors for a return of their money. At the same time, Vanguard was on the brink of bankruptcy. Allegedly, Ed orchestrated a desperately needed infusion of cash from a shady source in Miami, Florida. He then enlisted the services of his private investigator, Bob Gale. Gale was tasked with vetting Baker's new round of investors due to their rumored mafia ties. In the meantime, Ed was in the midst of a downward spiral. At approximately 7:30 p.m. on November 6th, he arrived at Mary's residence in a state of emotional distress. He was telling Mary that someone was trying to kill him. He told her that he'd been receiving death threats at his workplace for the past 2 weeks. And then, that morning, he received an anonymous phone call ominously declaring, "This is your day to die." Mary urged him to contact the police, but Ed dismissed the notion. He felt that the police would tell him there was nothing they could do until he was actually attacked. She implored him not to return home, suggesting he stay with her or at a hotel. But Ed insisted on going home, citing the need to reassure Sandy that he was okay. With that, Ed departed in his vehicle, making that the final time Mary would ever see him. According to Sandy, Ed had relocated her to her daughter's house in Austin, where he believed she would be safe from the threats. She recalled speaking with him around 1 a.m., during which he told her that he'd received another phone call. This time, the caller personally addressed him, telling him, "Baker, it's time to die." When Ed asked who was calling, the line abruptly went dead. At around 9:15 the following morning, a gardener observed a broken window at Ed's residence. Inside the bedroom, signs of a disturbance were evident. The phone lay discarded on the floor, an overturned ashtray littered the ground, and Ed's shotgun was conspicuously absent. Curiously, there was no signs of a burglary, and many of Ed's personal effects, including his jacket and wallet, remained untouched. After Ed's absence from work, authorities were notified of his disappearance. On November 8th, 1985, authorities were alerted to the incinerated Jaguar. Strangely, a witness reported the fire the previous day, but no one went to check it out until the 8th. Inside the car, amidst the charred remnants, lay the remains later identified as Ed's. Detective Ronnie Phillips surmised from the scene that Ed had sustained gunshot wounds. A burnt 32 caliber revolver was discovered on the passenger side floorboard, suggesting it had been at Ed's feet. Examination revealed an indentation on a cartridge, indicative of firing. The remaining 5 shells showed signs of heat-induced detonation. Additionally, a shotgun, also presumed to be Ed's, was recovered from the vehicle. Arson investigator Terry Byrd remarked that the attempt to incinerate the car was unmistakably deliberate. Inside and surrounding the vehicle were 3-gallon gasoline cans. Obviously, someone wanted to burn Ed's body beyond recognition. And then, as the investigators departed the scene, they stumbled upon another unsettling revelation. Roughly 1,500 feet from the car lay a second body. The victim, a young man in his early 20s, had been bound and fatally assaulted, seemingly within hours prior. Dressed only in a camouflage shirt, he bore the marks of a brutal beating. Initially, suspicions arose that he might have been Ed's assailant and that he was silenced to conceal the truth. However, an investigation revealed no connection between the two. Instead, it was determined that the man had fallen victim to a drug-related altercation. On that same day, Ed's case took another unexpected turn. A letter penned by Ed arrived at Ward's office. The letter reads, "Dear Ward, if you are reading this letter, it means that I am dead. I've had some threats on my life. You've been a good friend to me. Please take care of Sandy and the kids and do what you can for them. And enclosed is another letter that I would like you to take out to Sandy and give to her for me." In the ensuing weeks, speculation surrounding Ed's fate reached a fever pitch. Sandy, now residing in Europe, remained steadfast in her belief that he had fallen victim to a mafia-orchestrated hit. An eyewitness recounted to authorities about seeing a blue Chevy pickup truck with chrome rails and mag wheels fleeing the vicinity of the field where Ed's car was discovered. Despite their efforts, neither the truck nor its occupants have ever been located. Even though Ed confided in numerous acquaintances about the threats to his life, investigators maintain a belief that he killed himself. Their investigation revealed that in the days leading up to his death, Ed contacted his life insurance agents to inquire about the terms concerning suicide. One policy, valued at $500,000, would not provide coverage in such an event, much to Ed's alleged disappointment. Additionally, he wrote letters altering the beneficiaries of his insurance policies, excluding Vanguard and designating them to his family instead. If Ed were to kill himself, though, he couldn't have done it alone. Detective Phillips entertains the possibility that Ed shot himself and then had an accomplice set fire to the car to create the illusion of foul play. This would ensure the payout of all insurance policies. Phillips highlighted previous cases where individuals committed suicide in a vehicle using a firearm. In most cases, the consistent placement of the weapon is at the person's feet. When Ed was found, the recovered firearm was indeed positioned at his feet on the passenger side of the vehicle. Sandy adamantly rejected the notion of Ed taking his own life, and she appears to have a good reason. In a bid to salvage his company, Ed purportedly sought financial aid from a dubious source, a known organized crime figure in Miami, Florida. 6 weeks before Ed's death, he and Sandy ventured to Miami in an attempt to placate the individuals who had lent him the funds. Their aim was to negotiate an alternative repayment plan for the loan. On the evening of his disappearance, Ed reportedly confided in Sandy that the lenders were aggravated and threatened his life as a consequence. In contrast, Ward disputes the murder theory. He cites the letter Ed dispatched to him, specifically the beginning words, "If you're reading this, I am dead." Ward contends that Ed couldn't have foreseen his death unless he had planned to end his own life. He speculates that Ed anticipated potential incarceration and orchestrated his death to shield Sandy from being implicated in his illegal acts. Private investigator Bob Gale suggested that homicide remains a plausible scenario in this case. Nevertheless, he leans more on the notion that Ed might have found a way to place a different body in his car. Highlighting Ed's considerable intellect and financial prowess, Bob feels that such a capable individual could feasibly stage his own death. He maintains the belief that he absconded to an undisclosed destination, potentially the Caribbean, to live a life of opulence funded by embezzled investor funds. To his point, approximately $10 million from Vanguard remains untraceable. However, evidence recovered from the vehicle appears to corroborate the identity of the body as Ed's. As mentioned earlier, a ring and a shotgun, both believed to be his, were discovered within the car. Furthermore, the autopsy unveiled a striking resemblance between Ed's medical records and the dental remains found at the scene, with at least 60 points of similarity. In November of 1986, the investigation conducted by the Harris County Medical Examiner's Office concluded with an inconclusive determination regarding Ed's cause of death. The extent of his bodily destruction in the fire prevented a definitive determination. While the medical examiner leaned toward suicide as Ed's possible fate, insufficient evidence hindered conclusive determination. Notably, at least one insurance company declined to honor a policy under the presumption of suicide. Ed's story has assumed a legendary status in certain corners of Texas. While the likelihood of his survival seems slim, there are some who believe that there's still not enough proof. And that's the one thing that we just don't have. Proof. Did Ed choose to end his own life? Or was he the victim of immense greed like so many others before him? The answer to that question remains unknown. To this day, the death of Ed Baker is still an unsolved mystery.